quiet time and invite God into the room. Thank you. Hi, my name is Krishna. I'm a recovered drug addict. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. You know, the theme, you will be amazed. This is amazing to me, just to be asked, let alone be capable of conveying some type of message that's productive to life. It tells us to talk about it in a general way, what happened, what we were like, what happened, what it's like now. In the big book on page 29, it gives a more specific instruction. And it states, in our personal stories, we describe from our own point of view in our own language the way we established our relationship with God. And I did that through the 12 steps. And that's the only reason I'm here today. Nothing else. I could sit up here and describe how many times I went to prison, being homeless, jobless, all these things, to try to confirm my reason to be here. None of those things describe drug addiction. Going to prison is not a symptom of drug addiction. Being homeless is not a symptom of drug addiction. There's homeless guys right now on the bridge, never got high in their life. There's guys in prison right now, never got high in their life. So to talk about things that happened when I did drugs, that's not addiction. Addiction is what happened to me when I tried not to do drugs, right? And for a long time, I was confused. My first attempt at recovery was in 2004. I went to my second treatment. My first treatment center was at 12. Can't even tell you what happened there. I don't know. It didn't matter. I wasn't hearing nothing. I thought it was crazy that I was even here. I came home on PCP. My mom, the cops came and they took me to a rehab. I'm like, I don't need to be here. Are you people nuts? Like, it's normal for 12-year-olds to smoke PCP. In Chicago, it's not so abnormal, at least in my neighborhood. But anyway, in 2004, I went to my first treatment center. I was court-mandated, and I knew my problems in life, at least I thought I knew, my problems in life resulted to me getting high. And if I could just not get high, life would be great, right? Just don't get high, life would be wonderful. And I was under that perception, so these people came, there was a CA meeting and an AA meeting, and they carried their message, and, you know, they talked a lot about going to meetings, and, you know, this what's going on in their life, and, you know, my perception of a meeting was it was like this self-help for people who have this emotional disorder and need to talk to somebody. And that wasn't me. So I didn't hear nothing they said, and I was under the perception that I'm going to leave this treatment center and just not get high and life will be great. So I left the treatment center, successfully graduated, got the diploma and everything. And I went to a halfway house. And by me, so-called drug of choice, being heroin and being a junkie and a crackhead, I thought, well, liquor will be great. I'll drink some liquor. I just won't shoot heroin or smoke crack, and my life will be wonderful. So I went to the halfway house and proceeded to just drink liquor. So I thought, within a couple of weeks, I was back to what I do best. And from there started a cycle of going to prison, coming out with the desire to not pick up, right? I had a desire. And it was meetings, halfway houses, jail. Meetings, halfway houses, jail. Meetings, halfway houses, jail. For 5 years. I became that guy when I showed up at a meeting. It was like, why is he here? Today that baffles me. The only reason why we're supposed to be here, according to our fifth tradition, is for that guy. The only reason why we exist as a fellowship is for that guy. They didn't want me there. So, in, I don't even know what year it is anymore. Right, that's that year. And my second to last attempt at this, I had a sponsor and worked his version of the steps. And they had a wanderers group, and their home group was a wanderers group. And so I would go every Thursday to someone's $500,000 house, and this was like 2008 during the crash of the stock markets, and listen to some gentlemen who I'm sure were great people. I'm not discrediting anything of their character. But I was dying of alcoholism and addiction, and I learned how much money they lost on the stock market that week. I listened to how they drank on trips to Hong Kong. And these guys weren't like me, so I thought. I couldn't relate to them on how they got high and got drunk. Now if they maybe related how they tried to quit, I would understand, right? So I went back to jail. And this facility I went to was real big on recovery. There was a member of our fellowship there who actually worked there and ran a 12-step program inside the jail, which later became a 12-step section of the jail. It grew into its own section if you wanted help. And so I went to this guy's meeting. You know, I've been to hundreds of meetings, recovery, yeah, I want to go, right? Even though I was convinced it was bull, it didn't work because I'd been trying for 5 years. So I go to this guy's meeting, and he's like, who's new? And I raise my hand, and he's like, what's your name? I'm like, Christian, alcoholic, drug addict. He goes, so is alcoholic your middle name and drug addict your last name? And I'm still full-flight ego mode. I'm like, no, right? And he goes, so you've been to meetings before? I said, yes, sir, I've been to hundreds of meetings. He goes, so you know about recovery? I said, yes, sir, I know about recovery. He goes, you don't know shit about recovery. If you knew anything about recovery, you wouldn't be sitting here. And my first reaction was not something I want to say from the podium, right? Very unspiritual. And I went back to my cell. And my first, I believe these moments of clarity we have, which to me are gifts from God, because without them I would never be able to see any type of realization into my life. But I had this moment of clarity where that guy was absolutely right. I knew absolutely nothing about nothing. I knew nothing. And so I went back, and he started to really explain. He asked me, okay, so you're an alcoholic, you're a drug addict, what does that mean? And I proceeded to tell him of my trips to prison, the things I did while high, the things I did to get. And he's like, yeah, that's not what a drug addict is. You take any random person off the street and give them a physical dependency on a chemical where their body needs it, they're going to do funny things to get it. Detox that person, and with a clear mind, what happens? A drug addict goes and gets high again under the thought of, I'm just going to do this today, just one, and I'll be okay. I made that decision a million times with a sober mind. Just one bag, I'll be cool. Go get a job Friday. See my pro agent, drop clean Tuesday. And believed it. Believed it with a sober mind. That's a description of addiction, right? So he opened up this wonderful book here that's rarely read these days, and started to explain to me some things about drug addiction and what it means, the physical allergy, the mental obsession, which were things I never heard. Physical allergy, I didn't understand what that meant, you know? And he sat down and explained it to me, gave me reading assignments. And I remember I had a sponsor who gave me the big book, and he said, yeah, read Bill's story. And I read half of his story. I'm like, I don't want to read this crap. It didn't interest me, right? But this guy told me to read the doctor's opinions, there's a solution to more about alcoholism. And as I started to read and their description of the alcoholic, right, they described me to a T. When they talk about that mental state that precedes a relapse is the crux of my problem. I thought robbing people to get high was my problem. Not the mental state before, that means I'm sober when my problem as a drug addict happens. I was like, wow, I never knew that. Hundreds of meetings, right? So it gained my interest. And I read and I divulged deep into this book. And I was convinced that what the people that wrote this book suffered from what I suffered from. Because I was convinced people I met at the meetings weren't like me. I'd never drank on a plane to Hong Kong. I never lost money on the stock market. Right? But these people that talked about their utter inability to stop no matter what. Because I was that guy, I would get out of prison, and that morning, you could hook me up to a lie detector test and said, are you going to get high today? I absolutely not, sir. And I would pass with flying colors and be high 3 hours later. That's the baffling feature of what we suffer from. And 5 years into this is when I found that out, sadly. So once I became convinced that these guys who wrote this were like me, I became even more hopeful of the solution they claimed to have found, right? But it kind of threw me off because on 44 it says, I suffer from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. That sounds kind of deep for me, a spiritual experience, what the, right? But it talks about we recover from a hopeless state of mind. And for me, the definition of hopeless is I've ran out of options. I know from my past experience that when I leave here, I'm going to go get high, no matter what you tell me. Right? I've tried every method. I tried every plan. Nothing is going to work for me. And I had a little glimmer that this might, But the fact remained, I had no option. I had no plan for myself. And that's the definition of hopeless. I'm out of plans. Like, if I meet a newcomer, and this is his very first meeting, and I say, how you doing? Hi. Oh, good. Life is good. I'm tired of shit. I'm never getting high again. Really? You must be really confused about what you suffer from, let alone the guy is far from hopeless. In fact, he's full of hope. If he's full of hope, how can you recover from a hopeless state? You can't. It's impossible, right? So it took this journey I went on, and in retrospect, thank God for it, because that journey put me in that hopeless state where I was willing to do, which is a requirement before you start working the steps, willing to go to any length, including seeking God. There's no asterisk in that. And I was. Because life, as I've been living it, has become unbearable. So this whole spiritual experience that was the only method of recovery that these guys talked about, what did that mean, you know? And it talks about it in a few spots, but the part for me that really explains it were a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism or a profound alteration in my reaction to life. My reaction to life was to get high. Good day, get high. Bad day, get high. Got a girl, get high. Lose a girl, get high. Get a job, get high. Lose a job, get high. That was all I did, get high. Right? I got high. I started, got high. I didn't stop until they stopped me. Right? Okay, I'm done. I never said to myself, I had enough. Right? I ran out. I got to go get more. I will rob you and go get more. And eventually they put an end to that. So that was my personality. Everything I thought I knew, everything I thought I was, everything I thought I believed was going to change. How am I going to have this spiritual experience? Wonderful 12 steps, right? And through this process, I found out that the steps outlined in this book, really, they label them as clear-cut directions, right, are quite different from what I read on the wall. And then I found out what's on the wall is just a summary of the steps, not the actual working instructions of them. Lo and behold. So step one, I powerless over drugs. I used to think I was powerless over people, places, and things, and that was my problem. I was powerless over everything, and that was my problem. I didn't really know specifically what they were talking about. But again, it's in the literature. On page 24, it says, I have lost the power of choice. And I knew that to be true. Because every time I left prison and said, I'm not getting high, I wound up high, and it seemed beyond my mental state to make the choice not to. It just went full flight automatic mode. In the book, it says we have to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step. So in order to concede to my innermost self, I need to know what it means to be an alcoholic. Otherwise, I'm incapable of conceding anything. So when they gave their description and I had that moment of clarity to look upon my life and knew that I've made the decision a million times to not get high but always wound up high, I knew that I did not have the power of choice. I was going to get high no matter what. And I knew that in here, my innermost self. I knew it here for a while, right? Even though it wasn't explained to me, I knew something was off. But after being explained and reflected on my life with a moment of clarity given from God, I understood in here, I will get high again. That's when you understand step one. I will get high again. And then I got this step two. You know, can't believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. First, I got to understand what the insanity is they're speaking of. And it ain't about the people I robbed. It ain't about the things I did while on the chase. It's about that thought process I had with a sober mind that today I'm going to go get a bag of heroin, maybe a nickel rock, and tomorrow I'll be okay. And I was sober when I thought that. And they told me that if I ask God for help, he can help me. I had a little bit of faith only from the fact that this was coming from guys who I knew were just like me, and from a couple guys explaining it who I knew were just like me. And of course, that hopeless condition that I wanted help from. I'll do whatever it takes. So when they told me, you know, you gotta ask God for help, okay. What next? Right? And it talks about it a little bit, where it says, as soon as we are able to lay aside prejudice, a preconceived idea, what I think I know of God, and have a willingness, I'll get results. Right? So I was raised and thought and had all different type of beliefs, but the bottom line, they were belief, they weren't conviction. Two different things, right? But when asked, are you okay with God, to seek God to help, I was okay. Again, I had no other choice, right? I had no other choice. So I got to the third step, made a decision to turn my will, my life over to the care of God as I understood him, right? And the key thing I had to understand in the wording of this step, there's no letter A in front of God. You put the letter A in front of God and that changes everything. It doesn't say A God, it says God as I understand him. And my understanding was zero. But I was willing to seek and allow him to fill his understanding in my heart of what he wants me to understand, right? And in our literature, it kind of goes over why I need God and how I thought I was God, right? It talks about, you know, and for me, this was the big piece of the unmanageability or the first step, that I was under the delusion that I could rest satisfaction in this world if people only did what I wished. So I had this internal condition where I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. And as long as everyone did what I thought they should do, as long as everyone acted the way I thought they should act, my life would be great. And that was me playing God at its fullest. So a lot of things were explained to me on the third step, and the last instruction before the prayer is we think long and hard before making this drastic step, making sure we're entirely ready. And I thought long, like a month. I read all type of religious documents, spiritual books, because I wanted to be able to make this decision and believe what I was deciding, you know. And I also had to understand a decision is pretty much a decision of the mind, and for me, more importantly, of the heart. But any decision requires action, otherwise it was just an intention. I could sit here and tell you, when I leave here, I'm going to go to the store. And 5 hours from now, I'm just chilling. It became I intended to go to the store, right? So when I make this decision, I had to do some work to affirm the decision I've made, which, you know, we have these wonderful time references. And for the fourth step, from the third to the fourth step, there's two of them, next and at once, right? Next, we launched onto a vigorous course of action. Though our third step was a vital and crucial step, it'll have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a fourth step. So the day I made a decision with my sponsor and we hit our knees and did a third step prayer, we got up and he handed me a book, a notebook, to write my fourth step. And we went over the fourth step and he gave me my first instruction to make a list. And that was another one. I've actually done a fourth step, or thought I did a fourth step. I had a sponsor, and again, our premise here as a fellowship is we're supposed to be passing on information, right? Information to the newcomer of what we're about and how we get well. Somehow that information has become lost in opinion. And I did a fourth step. He told me, just write. I said, write what? He said, just write. And in a clear, sober mind, I thought it'd be a good idea to, from my mother's house to get to the train and to get to the west side of Chicago was about a 2.5 hour ride. That's plenty of time to start writing in my fourth step while I go get a bag of dope, right? He didn't tell me what to write, so I'm just gonna write some shit. I'll figure it out while I'm on the train. And I literally wrote part of a fourth step on the train to go get high and on the train coming back getting high. But anyway, he showed there's real descriptive on what we're supposed to do in a fourth step, and it's a series of lists, observations, and prayers, right? A lot of people are under the guise that a fourth step consists of writing. Writing's cool. I did a lot of writing in treatment. The relief came from the observations and prayers. And that's what the fourth step is about, to get relief from resentment, to get relief from fear, to get relief from the way I've been treating people. And writing about it changed nothing. I could go and do a million treatment packets about selfishness, resentment, and when I'm done, I'll still be resentful and selfish. This is about seeking God to change my heart, to remove the selfishness, to remove the resentment, to have some understanding, to no longer be angry, to understand that I need to be forgiven. In order to be forgiven, I also need to forgive, which is a wonderful way to get rid of resentment. So So I wrote out my four step and observed some things about myself and asked God to help me through some things, which got me to my fifth step. And it's the fifth step is kind of quite clear. I admit it to myself, to God, and to another human being, meaning the human being is not God, meaning the group of human beings is not God, right? And there was a lot of people. You could get a group of this size of people, and every one of them would know a tidbit about my life, right? No one knew everything. I had to compartmentalize everything. I can't let no one know me, right? And for the first time, I sat down with a human being, and we prayed and asked God to fill our hearts and help us be honest and humble and lose our fear in order to do this. And I told this man everything about me. Everything. And it was a humbling experience. Because I think we all have that one thing, right, that we don't want no one to know. And it usually involves something sexual, but we don't want no one to know, right? And he hit me. He's like, so that one thing you don't want to tell me, what is it? So I was in a proposition. Do I continue to live my life a lie, or do I try this to be fully honest? And on my own device, I'm incapable of being fully honest. I was able to only through God helping me by removing the fear to be honest. And I told this man everything about me. So we finished the fifth step, and he opened the book like he always did and showed me what instructions to do next. Return home for an hour. Review what I just done. Thank God that I know him better. Have I been thorough on my first five steps? And for guys who lie on that fifth step, guess what? If you're honest with yourself, you're going to realize you aren't thorough, and hopefully you'll pick up the phone and make the call and complete your fifth step. So it says, are you ready to have God remove these things? If yes, here's a seven-step prayer. And this is, you know, I'll get in debates with people about this higher power, God. And with guys I work with, I ask them one question. Is your higher power capable? Can you work step seven with him? Is he qualified to remove your defects? Because I could sit here and say, yeah, I got a group of drunks as my higher power. And I could sit here and tell you guys I'm dishonest and say, remove it from me now, please. You guys are incapable. Therefore, you don't fit the requirement under a higher power to work the steps. It's just that simple. And I'm not going to lie to a guy to keep him here, right? If the guy's not ready, he's not ready. Me lying to trick him, to have him sit down, is not going to help him. I actually hurt him. So I was ready, and I asked God. You know, I did a seven-step prayer and added a little in there. And it continues to this day. God, fill my heart with how you want me to be, how you want me to live, because I don't know. I could play God and think I know, but I usually end up behind a fence when I try that shit. So following the instruction in the book, I did my seven-step prayer, and it says, let's look at steps 8 and 9. You already have your list. You made it when you took inventory. 2 sentences on the eighth step in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Prepare to make amends. So my sponsor, he says, after you do all this, you read and follow the instructions, call me that night. So I called him later on, and his first question, what step are you on? I said, I'm on step 9, sir. He's like, okay, you follow the instructions. Set up your first appointment to make amends. And he gave me instructions to read and a little format of how to make the amends, because we get confused with the word to apologize and to amend. To amend means to change, right? So it's not about me going up to someone and saying, yeah, I robbed you, I'm sorry, right? It requires a little bit more work than that. And in this process of amends, the last question I ask when making an amends is, what can I do to make this right? When I fulfill what they asked me to do is the only time that amends is completed. If they say, you owe me $500, okay, I got you. I didn't make the amend until I gave them their $500. Right? Because I used to tell people I got them all the time. Well, you want 3 bags? Give me $30. I got you. Right? Same premise. I made about 3 amends, and my sponsor brought me to step 10, right? It says, and I'm just paraphrasing, but we start this way of living as we clean up the past. As we clean up the past, as we start making amends, you move on to step 10. And I used to hear people talk about 10, 11, 12 being the maintenance steps, to maintain. The actual instruction out of our literature says our next function is to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter, it shall last for a lifetime. So my role is to continue to always try to grow in understanding of effectiveness for the rest of my life, right? And when I'm no longer willing to grow, I'm in trouble. And step one's not true for me no more. I think I got some control over this now. I'm gonna decide today not to get high. I'm still incapable of making that choice. And you know, I hear people talk about a 10-step nightly inventory, right? In our literature, there's no such thing. It's actually the 11th step. The 10th step states, we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Continue to watch. Continue means never end. I continue to watch for these things. And it has real specific time references. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Like the 7th step, at once. Talk to someone immediately. Another time reference, immediately. Make amends quickly if we've harmed someone, another time reference, quickly. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. I have to do this as it happens on the fly, because if I wait till at night to do some type of 10-step inventory, I'll be doing it in a county jail, I'll be doing it in a crack house, dope house, bar, somewhere. I need to ask God at once to remove this. And I usually know when one of these things crop up because I don't feel okay. I feel something that's not okay. I may not be able to pinpoint what it is, but I know when I'm not okay, and that's when I need to pray, right? From there, I went to step 11, and here's where our nightly inventory kicks in, right? When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. I may have missed something on the 10th step. I'm not always some spiritual guru where I could just pick up, and sometimes I don't catch it. But when I review it at night, I'll catch it, you know? And there's a set of instructions on what to do. And then in the morning, upon awakening, I ask God to, divorce me from selfish, self-pity, self-seeking motives. Because left to my own device, I'll be full of self-seeking motives. I'll try to trick you into do something I want you to do, right? And that was another thing that was really paramount on me to understand. Motives. We hear a lot of talk about motives. Check your motives. Check your motives. Are your motives good? This is not a program of motives. It's a program of principle, right? Because when I do anything with a motive means I'm seeking a desired result. I'm still playing God. If I do principle, I don't care about the outcome. I care about what's in front of me right now. The outcome is for God to decide. I'll make anything sound good with a motive. I'm a dolphin, right? I don't care about the outcome. What's in front of me, right or wrong, do it. Let God determine the results. I spend too much time trying to determine results, and it doesn't work. I had to quit playing God, right? Which brought me, to our wonderful step 12. Wonderful step 12. Another misinterpreted, having had a spiritual awakening as a result? No, the result. The only result we offer is a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. We try to carry this message, not my sponsor's message, not the message I heard at the club, this message. Step 12 was originally printed in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the message they're referring to. This message. And thank God someone did that to me, right? And out of gratitude, I continue to do it. When I first got on the 12th step, the promise, nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. That's why I started doing 12-step work, was that promise that I won't pick up again. The joy that it brings to my life is why I do it today. There's the best feeling I have on a daily basis is when I leave a treatment center, halfway house, meeting with a sponsee. There's no feeling in the world. I have a friend who describes it as a straight shot of God for my junkies out there, right? It's an indescribable feeling that you can't describe in words. You just have to do it to understand, and those that do it know. Those that don't, I'm sorry. You're missing out on the biggest gift of this program. And again, there's real specific instructions on the 12th step, right? It says, suppose you don't know any alcoholics who want to recover. You can easily find some by asking your priest, minister, hospital. So in order to find, I must seek, right? It's my job to go out and find them, not sit in a club and hope someone asks me. Because people who are dying from this ain't making it to clubs. Some do. Most of them don't. And it furthers that instruction later on, and I don't know this off the top of my head, so I'm just going to repeat it. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. That is my job in 12th step, is to search out people like me who are dying, because they may not know this exists for me to sit here and hope they walk in. My job is to tell them precisely what happened to me through the 12 steps. And if they're ready and willing, they can change their life. If not, when they do become ready, they know where to look. Right? When I first read this book, and you know, I went to meetings and they read the promises, and they talked about all type of stuff that as someone dying of alcoholism, I was incapable of comprehending or understanding, right? And I didn't get why they even read it. And I later found out that those are known as the 9-step promises. And then I found out that each step has its own promises. And then I ran across our wonderful 10-step promises, which to me is the one thing in this book I didn't believe when I read it. I said, there's no way. I didn't believe it, but that's what I wanted. And I want to read a little bit of it because I don't think we talk about this enough. There's actually a workshop after this debating it, which baffles me. Stick to the literature, you won't be confused. We seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we find out that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. How many times have you heard, don't leave before the miracle happens. Ask someone what the miracle is and see if they know the answer. Right? We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. People, places, and things. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. What? The problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. It's not contingent on how many meetings you make. It's fit spiritual condition. How do I stay in fit spiritual condition? I continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness in my relationship with God. I didn't think this was possible. right? And the guy who taught me this book, he said, we absolutely recover from this. Furthermore, how sad would it be if we couldn't? How sad would it be if we couldn't? And when my sponsor took me through the steps, he had one condition for me. He says, if this works, do it for somebody else. More importantly, do not change the method. Do not change the method. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree. Somewhere along the lines, that's no longer true. There's going to be a debate in about an hour on it. Right? I'm grateful I went through what I went through to get here. I'm grateful someone shared this message with me when I was dying and needed it the most. I could sit here and tell you about my life and outside entities and possessions that I have acquired and jobs that I have, but none of that is as important as the problem has been removed. It does not exist for me today. Because that's the gift that you can't put a price on, you can't put a label on. Not only do I sleep well at night, my mother sleeps well at night. You know? And that's why, that's what we offer in Cocaine Anonymous, a spiritual experience. And I'm just glad, again, that the gratuitous that I have for people who actually get involved and do this work and this method and go out of their way to find people who are dying. Because that guy saved my life. And I would challenge everyone, if you don't have a commitment to a treatment center, halfway house, rehab, we have but one primary purpose as a fellowship, and that's to carry this message. And if we all carried this message and done our part, there'd be less mothers crying. And thank God my mom is not. That's all I have. Thank you for listening.